Hey everyone, and welcome to the Science Bloggers Podcast. I'm David Latchman, the host of this podcast. And if this is your first time here, thank you for joining us. And if you're a returning listener, thank you for coming back. I hope you're all staying safe and healthy during this pandemic, and I hope you all enjoy this episode. My guest this week is Jake Schreiber. Jake is a wildlife biologist studying waterfowl population and disease ecology. Jake's study encompasses many states in the southeastern U.S. and focuses on the wood duck and the factors that influence the stability of the wildlife population. Jake is not only measuring how many wood ducks there are out there, but also the microbiome of the artificial nesting structures where these ducks lay their eggs. Some bedding materials we use may have a negative impact on the duck eggs by promoting bacteria that kills the eggs in the nesting box. Jake also writes about parasites on his blog, Art of Infection, where he looks at the various diseases caused by these creepy, crawly parasites. So, hello, Jake. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, David?
I am fine. So, I guess, you know, you're probably at home right now due to the stay-at-home pandemic thing that's going on right now.
I am at home today, but I'm kind of just doing office work. Where my field work is, and so I'm working in Florida and Georgia. We have the okay from my graduate university to continue working, and so we do that in conjunction with our state collaborators as well. So as long as they're still working and still allowing us to utilize their equipment, then we're still good to be outside doing our data collection.
Oh, okay. So why didn't you tell the listeners a little something about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, of course. First off, thank you. Also, I forgot to say thank you for having me on. I'm really excited to do this. So I am a wildlife biologist and graduate student. I'm currently working on my master's at Clemson University. And in particular, I am studying waterfowl population and disease ecology. And we can, you know, love to chat more about that here in a little bit too. But that's kind of what is taking up a lot of my life right now is my graduate work. And right now in particular, I'm in my field season, which runs from January through mid-July is kind of our estimated time of conclusion for field work. And we are in our busy season right now because all of our ducklings are hatching. So we are doing anything from 15 to 20 boxes in a day that are set to hatch. And these boxes will contain anywhere from 0 to sometimes up to 20, 25 ducklings, depending on how large the clutch size is.
Wow.
So we're in our busy season right now.
Okay. So what got you into wildlife biology?
So my initial track in pretty much junior high, even younger than junior high, through high school and into college was I wanted to be a vet. And I wanted to do something with animals. And as I continued into school, I learned pretty quickly that I was having a really difficult time with some of the coursework that's required for veterinary school. And this includes things like biochemistry, pretty much the chemistry courses. I was having a very difficult time with that. And I ended up hearing about a program through the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, that was focused on wildlife biology and allowing students to do wildlife education, wildlife research. And so I got started at Stevens Point. I transferred in and was pretty much thrown into research right away. I got connected with the person who would quickly become my advisor. And she threw me into a research project right away. And so that was kind of how I moved into wildlife. And then for disease ecology, disease ecology is more my background and kind of my research preferences. And I got into that pretty early on. I was a wildlife rehabilitator for a number of years. I worked at a clinic. And so I got to work very closely with the veterinarian there studying diagnostics, and every now and again we get parasite cases that came in. And those were the ones that really drew me into wildlife disease ecology in particular.
So why parasites in particular? What was so fascinating about them?
Oh man, they're just the coolest. So you have an organism that is perfectly designed to infiltrate and in some cases take over, but in most cases infiltrate and just sit quietly and take resources from its host. It's something that is just very, like, how can you not be intrigued by something like this? Especially looking at something like, you know, most of my work is focusing on wildlife parasites and wildlife diseases, but even something like human parasites, you know, these are, human body is immensely well set up as a security system. And yet you have organisms that can somehow manage to wheedle their way past those security defenses and kind of set themselves up for success.
Oh, that, yeah, I guess, you know, for an organism to set themselves up as a parasite, you know, you have to find some way to avoid the host body's immune system.
Right. Avoid killing your host. These are all things that are very uniquely set up for something like parasites and other diseases too.
Yeah, because, you know, if your food source is dead, you know, that's not a good thing.
Right, exactly.
So are there any special techniques some parasites manage to do this?
So there's, I'm trying to think of the name of the parasite, but it will slowly infect certain species of snails, and they will essentially start influencing the snail's movement and brain control of sorts, and will cause the snails to crawl up into an area that allows birds to see them. And the birds will then eat the snails, and the parasites will then begin their life cycle, their full life cycle inside of those birds. The birds are their preferred host. So that's just, I mean, that's one method. Parasites that I've studied, they use earthworms as a host, as a temporary host, in order to get things like prairie chickens, turkeys, and other upland game bird species to pick them up and eat them so that they can begin their full life cycle as adults in those upland game birds.
Yeah, because I remember a few years ago, they were talking about, I think it was toxoplasmosis, if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it caused rats to become fearless, and they would approach cats, get eaten, and the cats would defecate, and the bacteria, I believe it is.
The young parasites are the, when they're still kind of in their egg stage.
Right. So rats would come across the cat feces and they would get infected and the cycle begins anew. So, you know, the cat gets food and, you know, the bacteria, is it a bacteria? Parasite.
It's a parasite. It's a parasite.
Yeah. They get to reproduce again. I mean, it's not good for the rat, but, you know.
No, not at all. But whatever that has to do to keep that life cycle going.
Yeah. So you also have a blog, Art of Infection, right? So what prompted you to start a blog about parasites?
So a couple of reasons. The first was because I had just graduated from undergrad. I got my bachelor's and I had moved into the field to begin my first full-time position as a biologist. And I was doing something that was not disease-related. And so this was an attempt for me to make sure that I was staying in the literature and I was reading what was going on in the field that I, you know, really love. But then the other reason was I was bored. You know, we're in the field in middle of nowhere, South Carolina. And so, you know, this was something to take my mind off of, or give my brain something to do. And I like writing and, you know, I love reading about diseases and stuff. So this seemed to be the perfect opportunity and way to keep myself busy when we weren't working.
Yeah, because, you know, I find like one of the great things about blogging is that you get to tell these stories about, you know, these wonderful things, or at least what you think is wonderful. And hopefully you'll convince someone else, hey, this is interesting enough to read. I'll give your article a try.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it also it helps you find your people, too. I had started posting my articles on Twitter, and that helped a lot, too. It helped me actually find some really great colleagues and people who were, you know, maybe not in my field of disease ecology, but who were still very interested in the stuff that I was writing about, and vice versa, too. I had conversations with them about their research and the stuff that they're doing.
So it's a good way for an academic to network.
Definitely. Oh, yes.
So I was reading some of your articles, you know, recently, and quite a few of them, you know, kind of like stood out, right? One was My Eyes, Parasites.
Ooh, yes.
Contact Lenses.
Oh, yes.
So there were a few things that struck out. So I think you said like 1 in 45 million people wear contact, but about 40 to 90% of them don't properly care for their lenses. And as a result, nasty things can happen. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so, and that was a new one for me too. That was kind of just an accident of sorts. You know, I was kind of looking online. I was trying to find something cool to write about. And, you know, you see this picture, and I think I used it as the cover photo for that particular post. But you just see this picture of this poor person with their eyes all clouded and bloodshot. And it made me stop to think too, because I, you know, I wear contacts too, and I can probably say that I do not follow, or did not, I do now, but I did not follow proper cleaning protocols until I started really researching that. And it is a huge risk. You hear, you know, you hear from eye doctors and, you know, my parents, you know, your parents and everyone telling you to make sure you clean your contacts and make sure things are being taken care of. But parasites, I feel like, is not really a thing that people generally think of as being a risk when you get contacts. It's more so bacteria or just gross, nasty stuff on your fingers if you're not washing your hands while handling your contacts. Parasites, I don't think, are the top concern for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think you're correct, especially if you live in a developed country, until the water is supposed to be clean. So you really don't think that if you use improper cleaning protocols, you might actually be harming yourself, or you may introduce a parasite into your contact lens. So that's kind of like amazing that could happen.
Yes.
You know, because I think it's the guy in your article, right? He became blind. Did he become blind?
Yeah. Yep. He become blind. I can't remember if it was a permanent blindness. I believe it was, though.
And he did it because he just kept wearing it throughout the day, probably longer than he should have. And yeah, he showered with it.
Showered.
And again, you know, it's like
swimming. No, yeah, showering, swimming with your contacts in, which I have done, and I'm sure many other people have done before. These are, yeah, very easy ways for these nasty critters to get in. It's one of those methods of infiltration that they have eventually developed.
They have evolved to do it pretty well, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
if they're still around, I mean, that means they're doing whatever they're doing well.
Yes. Correct.
So based on that article, if you were to talk to someone, how should they clean their contact lenses?
A big one is ensuring that you're using proper saline solution. So they, you know, don't use water from the faucet, from your tap. That's not how you clean your contacts. You always want to make sure that you wash your hands and be using the solution sold either by your eye doctor, or you can find it usually in the eye section of your grocery stores. Those are probably the biggest ones, is make sure your hands are clean and use the proper solution. Additionally, and I think we mentioned this in the article too, you know, make sure that you're not wearing your contacts when you are exposing yourself to water, whether it's from the tap or you're swimming. I think I said something in there too about not swimming in a hot tub, especially with your contacts in, because they're gross and very easily infectable, or very easy infected with nasty things inside of there. Those are probably the biggest ones.
Yeah, I do remember the hot tub one, and I think not many people realize, you know, how much bacteria is in a hot tub.
Yeah.
And you may think it's like, oh, well, it's hot water, but it's not hot enough to actually kill a lot of bad stuff. So something to think about.
Yes, exactly.
So another one of your articles was on chronic wasting disease, and it's caused by prions. So what exactly is a prion?
The prions are essentially evil proteins. We have normal proteins that are in our bodies and in our brains, but prions are essentially misfolded proteins. and they can get into the brain, and they'll form these cysts inside of your brain that will eventually lead to, that can eventually lead to pretty nasty diseases. And this goes for people and for wildlife as well. Things like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, mad cow is another disease that's caused by a prion. And I will say too, that article on chronic wasting disease, I believe it's the infographic, that was written by some colleagues and friends of mine at the Seeking Science blog, which if you haven't read them before, I highly recommend their blog. They make some really very cool infographics to help get their point across.
Yeah, they do. I've checked their website before. So yeah, I also recommend that blog if anyone's interested. And so two of the other articles also deals with bobcat fever and bighorns. And it seems that domesticated animals can transfer diseases just as much as wildlife can transmit parasites to them. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, definitely. And that goes for things like chronic wasting disease too. You know, there's a really huge concern with CWD that, you know, this disease is still being transmitted because you have wild deer interacting with farm-raised deer. And especially something like chronic wasting disease, it takes nothing to get that thing passed from one deer to another. It's a very easy disease to pass around.
Wow. So with bobcats, they have this parasite. I don't know how to pronounce it. Cytoxon?
Yep, cytozoan. Cytozoan.
Cytozoan felis. And it's transmitted by ticks. And apparently house cats can get it. And if they do, they can die in 2 to 3 days. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Wow. So why exactly does that progress so quickly?
Part of it has to do with the fact that it is a blood parasite. So that, you know, automatically is usually equals a pretty nasty parasite anyway. Bloodborne parasites are, think of something like malaria. These are parasites that can infect and hide extraordinarily well, considering they're in a pretty active zone like the bloodstream, or in an area where blood is active. And so these are pretty detrimental parasites especially compared to others too. But bloodborne parasites can be pretty nasty.
Yeah. And for bighorn pneumonia, apparently it's primarily transmitted by domestic sheep. Is that correct?
Yes, they are definitely definitely carriers, and they do pose a problem to wild bighorn sheep, for sure.
Because I think you mentioned somewhere in the article that sometimes, like, farmers graze on federal lands.
That's correct.
I'm not too sure about the legal part of it, but farmers usually get permission from the federal government.
Yeah,
hopefully.
That's correct.
To graze.
Yep. And that's pretty normal, especially out west. There's a lot of ranching programs that go on out west, where farmers can lease out sections of land to raise cattle and sheep, goats, things like that.
And I guess that plays a very big part of wildlife management. It's making sure that farmers can feed their cattle, but at the same time not hurt or damage the surrounding wildlife.
Correct. Yeah. So this is where we kind of start to delve into things like human dimensions research, human dimensions of wildlife, which is our interactions as wildlife biologists with members of the public. And so we consider ranchers and farmers to be one of our top groups of what we would call a stakeholder group. These are all people who have a right to this public land as much as everyone else. And so, but there is a certain level of trickiness that goes on with that too, because there sometimes are differing opinions for how that land should be used. And it is can be a really huge part of the job, is learning how to interact and compromise and work with these stakeholder groups. Because in the end, we all want the same, we all are striving for the same goal. And, you know, that primarily being to ensure conservation of wildlife and natural habitat.
Yeah, I guess that's a form of science communication as well. It's being able to communicate to those stakeholders why you've made a decision that they don't want, but why it might be in their best interest.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to do that?
Not me personally, at least to the extent of some biologists. For my graduate work, we do some stuff with members of the public where, you know, a lot of our nest boxes that we're using for our wood duck study, they're all on public land. And so they're all either on ponds and lakes that are actively being fished by members of the public, hunting land. So these are all, it's not uncommon for us to interact with members of the public. And, you know, usually it's everyone's curious. They want to know because most people don't really know what these wood duck boxes are used for. And so you just see a big wooden box on the landscape. And it's a lot of times really fun to chat with them about the sorts of things that use those boxes.
Okay, cool. So you're now a scientist during a global pandemic, and we have to be aware of things like social distancing. How is that affecting work and research?
For me personally, it hasn't had that huge of an effect on my research. I live in a very isolated area in Florida, as well as my field site in Georgia is pretty isolated too. So we are still able to work. I have a staff of 4 technicians that work with me on this, and we don't really have too much of an issue with that. However, I have plenty of friends and colleagues that are currently shut down or are very unsure as to if they're going to be able to continue their research as graduate students and as professionals as well.
Yeah, because I know a few people who are in that situation where they have no idea what's going to happen. You know, some people are first-year graduate students and they have no idea if there's going to be a project for them in the future. You know, it's a very uncertain time for a lot of people.
It's scary. It's definitely scary.
Well, I'm glad that at least you're doing well. So, you know, that's a relief.
Yeah, we're glad to be able to keep working for now. Hoping it can stay that way for the remainder of the season.
And not just the season, you know, we might be in this pandemic thing for the long haul, you know, depending on how things go.
Right.
So hopefully it stays that way for you.
Yeah.
So as far as science communication goes, do you have like any personal thoughts as to how it should be done or who you need to communicate to?
I can definitely say that I've been learning a lot since I started doing this, and especially since I started posting on Twitter and getting to know other folks that are actively doing science communication as a career even. People like Corinna Newsom, Sarah McAnulty, these are all people who do this actively for a job and for their, you know, just daily lives. And so it's definitely helped me to learn how to write more for general audiences. I think that was the first post I wrote for my blog. I went through multiple drafts where I kind of would send it to my family and they, you know, there was some thoughts of like, oh, this is really jargony or this is very long. And so that was a big one for me, was learning how to write more for the general public. And something that I would encourage other bloggers and people who are in SciComm to make sure that they're doing is to ensure that when you're writing, you want to make that as simple, not simple, but as easy to understand as possible. Because the purpose of this generally is to draw more people in from the public to see what we do as scientists and to, you know, show them that we are people and we're not trying to hide ourselves away. We want to share our research and make sure that it's understandable by everyone.
Yeah, I think that is so important as well, because I think for the most part, the public generally has a wrong conception of what a scientist is. And maybe that's in part due to popular culture. You know, we watch TV and we watch movies and the portrayals aren't always nice, right? So
right. Yeah.
That's something that we definitely need to work on.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like there's been a really huge pulse of this, especially within the last year and a half or so. And it's really great to see because of that, you know, kind of common misconception. I think, you know, the saying is usually something about an ivory tower, scientists up in our ivory tower away from everyone else. And there's been a really huge push to break that stereotype and show that, you know, we're generally pretty cool people, and we want to share what we're doing because it is really cool. Our research is very cool, usually.
Yeah, I think so as well. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think what you want to show, it's a job that's not quite different from anyone else's. You know, good days, there are good, bad days. There's problem solving, like in any job that you do. You know, it's just you're doing something different.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So we've covered like quite a few things. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that you didn't get a chance to or say?
I'd love to share a little bit about my current research if you have the time.
Sure, I would love to hear about it.
So I'm currently working on a pretty wide scale project with my advisor, and this is a project that's encompassing many states within the southeastern U.S. And even up into the midwestern states as well. We've got collaborators as far north as Delaware and Maryland, and as far west as Mississippi and Louisiana, and even up into Wisconsin as well. And the purpose of our work is to shine some light on the wood duck in particular. And so the wood duck is a species that for a while was thought to be pretty well known, and we had a general idea of about how they did things until we got a group of waterfowl ecologists from state and federal agencies, from local universities together in late 2018. And we started asking questions. And the big one that came up was about wood ducks and their populations, because the last kind of research studies that were done showed that their populations are kind of okay, and, you know, maybe not great. In particular, we were focusing on something called recruitment, which is a population ecology term that generally refers to, in the case of wood ducks at least, female ducklings that hatch and migrate out and then return to that same area, that same population that they hatched from the following year, to re-nest and help contribute to the population. And so recruitment studies that were done formally showed only about 5%, which is not ideal. We want to hopefully see something as high as 12, maybe even as high as 15% for a recruitment rate to show that populations are stable and doing fine. So that was our primary question. And so that's something that we're currently working on right now. And we're doing this by banding hen, female wood ducks. And then we're also coming back in 30 days to collect ducklings and put a specialized web tag, or specialized tag that goes in the webbing between their toes on their feet. And this is a method of what we would call a mark recapture study. So we mark the ducklings, and then we come back the next year and see how many of the babies we tagged came back to re-nest in that area. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, yeah.
Okay, perfect. So then that's a huge aspect of my thesis, is this, you know, population ecology and recruitment study. And then additionally, I'm looking at the microbiome of these artificial nesting structures that the wood ducks use to nest in. These are large wooden boxes. And there's been some studies that were done that showed that, yeah, you know, there are some microbes that grow inside of these boxes that can attach to the eggs and can essentially rot the eggs and ensure that, the eggs do not hatch. So that's something else that we're doing right now down here, is I am swabbing eggs with sterile swabs, and we're putting these swabs onto plates and seeing what microbes grow from these eggs and see if there's any correlation between the number and type of microbial colonies and then the number of eggs that were rotten inside of these boxes at the end of the year.
So let's say that these microbes are preventing eggs from hatching. Is there anything we can do? Is it causative by is it caused by anything that we're doing or not doing?
So kind of what previous studies have shown is these are pretty normal microbes to be found, especially within wood ducks. A lot of them were gastrointestinal microbes, because you know the hens are pretty much constantly pooping on their eggs. And so this, you know, can in one sense build up an immunity. However, there are some other microbes that will infect the egg itself. So that's something else that we're looking at as well, is we're looking at different types of shavings to put inside of the boxes. Cedar shavings are a pretty common type to be used by managers. And cedar shavings in particular have some pretty potent natural oils inside of them that promote an antimicrobial environment. And so we're looking at that, and we're also going to be looking at two other types of shavings, a pine, which not as potent with the oils, and then aspen, which should have next to nothing inside of it to protect the eggs. So we're going to be looking at eggs and microbes from boxes that contain those three types of shavings and see if there's any difference in types of, or amount of growth and type of microbial growth.
Okay, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll get an answer soon. So I guess we can start closing up now. So do you want to tell the listeners like how they can follow you on social media or contact you if they have any questions or anything?
Yes, of course. So I think you already said that the blog is The Art of Infection. I'm working on a couple of posts right now to be putting up in the next couple of weeks. I am on Twitter, and that's at jsherba. And I'm on Instagram as well, and I post some pretty cool stuff revolving around waterfowl ecology, some disease stuff. And my tag for that is jsherba93.
Okay, that sounds great. So I hope everyone who listens will at least check you out and give you a follow.
Definitely. Thank you. Thanks again. This was great. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and it was great having you as well. So, you know, if anything changes, hopefully we can do it again.
That'd be fantastic.
Thank you for joining me, and I hope you enjoyed my talk with Jake. I hope you learned as much as I did about wildlife biology and parasites and science communication as I did. Be sure to check out Jake's blog, The Art of Infection, for everything related to the fascinating science behind parasites. If you can, please share, subscribe, or even leave a comment wherever you listen to this episode. Every bit of support for this show helps. This podcast also has two Facebook groups, one for science content and the other one for science communicators. So check it out if you're interested in either community. All links are in the episode's description. This podcast also has a Patreon, so check it out if you can. And any contribution you can make would really help support this show. And be sure to stay safe and healthy during this pandemic. I hope you'll all join me for the next episode when I talk to a new guest.